Welcome to Poor Decisions, a podcast about craft beverages from inside the industry. Our primary focus is on wine, and often from the Midwest, but topics include other craft beverages and products. Basically, anything you can pour is fair game. I'm Brian Lesperance. I'm the host of this thing. I've been doing this wine business for about 13 years. I'm run the operations at Fen Valley Vineyards, where our studio is located just outside of the crush pad. Busy day there yet again today. I live right here in Fenville, Michigan. It is a beautiful time of year as we are in the throes of harvest. This is the second of 2025 harvest updates. So these are going to be generally audio only, shorter formats, just kind of a quick take on what's going on around here on a weekly basis. It's pretty chaotic, as it typically gets right about now. Usually that third week of September is sort of the heart of harvest for us here at in the Fenville AVA. So we got a lot of stuff going on. I've talked to quite a few winemakers around town the last week or so, and I think everybody's kind of full on into it right now. So this format will often or sometimes include guests that I can maybe get to call in for a little bit during the fog of harvest, but a lot of times just be me kind of burning through what came in this week, some general observations of how harvest is going, as well as a couple of deep dives. So one thing I wanted to do, like I did in the first one, is kind of talk about a particular grape, usually one that we picked this week, and then also part of the sort of harvest process, a deeper dive on what's going on with a particular aspect of harvest. So today we're going to cover the grape Cayuga White, which is a hybrid grape. We'll get more to that in a bit. And then for the This Won't Pour segment, which is the deeper dive, we're going to look at how we pick grapes. This is a question I get a lot on tours, and so it's one that I'm going to try to shed a little light on here this afternoon, today. Poor Decisions is presented by Fen Valley Consulting Services. Fen Valley Services is a specialized division of Fen Valley Vineyards dedicated to providing expert winery management and consulting services. With over 50 years of industry experience, we help farmers, winemakers, and wine marketers build successful, sustainable businesses. As a trusted winery management company, we offer customized, consultative solutions tailored to the unique needs of each client. Whether you need assistance with winery or tasting room operations, complete winemaking services, e-commerce support, or something else wine-related, our team of experts provides the experience and hands-on support needed to elevate your winery's success. Learn more at www.fenvalley.com. Anyway, here we go. So starting out, as far as overarching kind of concepts of harvest, here we in as we approach the sort of that end of the first third, I would say, for picking, we've been, you know, wrapped up all the sparkling picks. We've wrapped up a lot of the really early stuff. We're on to kind of that beginning of the what is often a lot of white grapes for still wines, as well as some of the earlier reds are certainly in the cellar at this point. So there's just a lot going on. This week specifically was kind of an odd week for us in that it was low on the actual types of grapes that we picked for Fen Valley, at least, although we worked with some others that came through our facility because we do some cooperative work as well. But it is definitely the quantity of those sort of made up for it a little bit. So we've been busy. Plus, we just are gearing up for what is likely going to be a really, really busy couple of weeks on the horizon. Growing season continues to be pretty great. We've been very dry here all summer, really, ever since we had kind of a wet, cold start. We've been either over warm or above average for the rest of summer, pretty much, with an exception of like an 8-day stretch there where we were below average, which is, good, I guess. I would say the grapes are a little stubborn in ripeness right now, and we're kind of attributing that to a couple of factors. One is we don't have a lot of irrigation here, so we're definitely in a drought-stressed environment. You're seeing some leaf color change on the leaves, particularly those closest to the grape clusters that are clearly exhibiting some stress from the lack of rain. And then I think also we've had some pretty warm nights the last few weeks, or last a week rather, and really it's that sort of, as I think I mentioned in the last harvest update, it's that cycle of the warm days and the cool evenings that really drive that ripeness in. And so I think we're seeing a little bit of both that has kind of slowed things down a little bit for us. But that said, we're still probably about average right now for what comes in when, maybe a couple days behind, but that's really nothing to be too concerned about. We do see some rain on the forecast horizon, which might interfere with some of our picking plans for the following week. But as far as The weather is concerned. The good news is we've had very low humidity. So that definitely helps to keep our dew at a low level, which that's one of the challenges we get this time of year in Southwest Michigan is we do get a lot of dew in the mornings as we get that cooling off overnight. And so that can just wreak havoc with some of the real sensitive, botrytis sensitive varieties like Riesling, Vignole, can be somewhat sensitive to that. Sauvignon Blanc, although it picks a little bit earlier. Same with Pinot. All the Pinots, but they all get picked pretty early, so they don't tend to see too much issue with that as long as you've managed it well going into the season. Good leaf pulling to get good fruit exposure, things like that. So quality of the fruit looks really good. So I think things can hang as long as the leaves can hang on. You know, we're probably still a month out at least on some of the Bordeaux. So we're still definitely in, you know, active disease scouting and farming as far as that's concerned. So that's kind of the big picture right now. Next week, like I said, we're really forecasting bringing in all the Pinot Gris, probably more Chardonnay now for still wine. We did that for sparkling, which we talked about last week. We may be bringing in some other stuff too, some Muscadet Adel, which is doing pretty well this year. That one's sometimes a challenge to get ripe the way we like it. So we're definitely, you know, happy with the way things are sitting today. But it's busy, like I said. So we're just going to kind of rip through this today and give you guys an insight of what's going on. So, as far as what we picked two different grapes off of our farm this week. And they're both hybrids. So let's step back just a bit and talk about the difference between hybrids and vinifera. So the classic wine grapes are of a genus species, Vitis vinifera, which is, you know, they're planted all around the world. They've thought to have originated in southern France, the Middle East, and they've been obviously taken elsewhere, but they certainly, you know, still have thousands of years of DNA that's optimized for that growing climate. So, you know, that area has poor soils, a lack of moisture, an abundance of heat units. And so as they've been transplanted around the world, there's, you know, they've had challenges, you know, challenges from that disease pressure to cold hardiness to vigor, getting things ripe. There's all kinds of stuff that different places can do better than others. But the overarching theme is that, you know, the Midwest and the home of Vitis vinifera have a lot of differences. And so, you know, we'll get into more of this on another podcast, but our proximity to Lake Michigan gives us a temperate climate that really does mitigate a lot of those challenges that we would face. Doesn't eliminate them, but it mitigates the downside risk alongside very light soils here along the lake shore and a lot of rolling hills. So we kind of take advantage of all three of those to pull this off, but it's still close. You know, we're still going to see some crop loss here and there from cold winters. We're still going to see a vineyard that, you know, probably averages 20 to 30 years of productive life where it would last quite a bit longer in an environment with less, you know, cold. And so, and we're still going to struggle in terms of getting things ripe. You know, like I said, Bordeaux reds are going to be coming off in, you know, mid to late October. That's getting pretty extreme in terms of the farming window here in Southwest Michigan. So there's another type of grape that is made by taking the vinifera, a vinifera parent and crossing it with a grape that's native to North America. And sometimes it's multiple crosses we're going to talk about here in a minute. But that's sort of the conceptually how it works at the highest level. And so the idea is just to take sort of the best of both worlds, right? You get this big flavors and acids and sugars that the vinifera grape has developed, which is somewhat unusual. If you've ever eaten a lot of other fruits, and we grow a lot of fruit along the lakeshore here in Michigan, so we're all sort of familiar with it. But, you know, most of your fruits are coming in between like 10 and maybe 14% sugar. Think about apples or in that range, blueberries, cherries, sometimes will float a little bit higher if it's real droughty. But, you know, wine grapes being north of 20 Brix or over 20% sugar puts them in sort of a minority camp in terms of the fruits that also pack flavors and acids that make them good for fermented beverages. And so that's really what you're trying to carry into the merger, if you will, of these two types of grape. And then, of course, the grape that evolved in our area, you know, something like a Vitis labrusca grape vine would carry with it disease resistance, could definitely be more cold hardy, may be more effective at ripening sooner. In other words, if you actually look at the plants, their leaves are literally bigger, which is part of it, but there's more to it than that. It just makes them more efficient. So you can get fruit ripe faster and you can hang often more tons per acre. You can really take advantage of that DNA. And so we have both on our farm, and we think they both serve an important purpose for what we're trying to do, both in terms of predictability of harvest or a crop rather, because the hybrids are going to deliver most years, even if we have a pretty bad winter or a marginal growing season. And we can farm them usually a little more efficiently, so we can bring bottles of wine at different price points. But we also like working with vinifera. You know, this is a special spot that we're sitting here in the Fennville AVA, and we have the, we're fortunate to be able to grow things like, you know, Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay, as we talked about last week, and Pinot Gris. And so we do both. And I so often tell folks when they come on tours, it's a little bit like if I was a financial advisor and I was telling my clients to have a sort of balance of their portfolio based on their risk tolerance and things like that. And it's kind of like that to me. It's, you know, the hybrids often are kind of that blue chip stock that performs really great every year, is, you know, makes some really solid wines. And, you know, for us, at least, that's sort of how we see it in our ecosystem. And then you've got things like Sauvignon Blanc that are kind of that, you know, that tech stock where it's going to be all up and to the right, or it's going to be crash and burn. And, you know, you're not going to necessarily be able to predict which one it's going to be until that fruit is in the cellar. And I think there's another factor of that, too, which is for some of these newer hybrids, you know, we really haven't been making wine out of them for very long. So it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing as far as, you know, when we're talking about Chardonnay like we did last week, you know, that grape has such a long history that winemakers have learned from past experience and how to vinify that wine in a bunch of different styles. You could contrast that with something like a Marquette that's much newer to the market. And I think the reality is we're probably going to see these wines evolve a lot in the next, you know, 10 or 15 years as we gain experience on how to craft them into beverages that the consumer likes. And to be sure, there's some great ones out there right now, but it reminds me a little bit of the stories I heard of even vinifera in the United States in the 50s and 60s, where, you know, there was a lot of collaboration, a lot of learning going on, a lot of really rapid innovation. So it's an exciting space for us to kind of be involved in. And it's fun. And I think it's exciting for us to be able to kind of be in both of those buckets, if you will. And we have wines that are blends of both. So there's absolutely no reason that they can't work together, even in the bottle. So I set the table with that because the two grapes we picked this week are both in the hybrid camp. And one is Foch, which is a little bit on the older side in terms of hybrids. This is one that's been on our farm since the get-go. So we planted that in the mid-70s, and it's still here productively growing for us. And it makes great wine. You know, we use it a lot as a component of a couple of our... we have a semi-dry red that it's a really great component. We use it as a component in a rosé that we do here. So it's very versatile. Its Achilles heel is it tends to bud out really early in the spring. So it's a little bit of a risk for frost and freeze damage in those late season, you know, spring frost events. But if it gets through spring, it's going to be pretty bulletproof. The other is another grape called Cayuga White. And that's the one I'm going to dive into next. We picked that today. This week rather. It's a super important component of our program. It forms one of three grapes that goes into our product that we call Sonata, which is a blend of Riesling, Cayuga White, and Sauvignon Blanc. And so we view it as a very important part of our portfolio. We have it growing here in Fennville, as well as with one of our partners a bit further south of us. So it's a little bit of history on it. So it's a French American hybrid. It's relatively modern in terms of the actual Cayuga grape. It was developed by Cornell University out in New York. But its actual history goes back quite a bit. So it started as far back as about 1850 with one of its parents, the Winchell grape, also known as Green Mountain. That's thought to be a natural cross. And it's one that has become kind of a foundation for a lot of other hybrids. So I think as we do this segment in the future, we'll probably see Winchell come back up again. Then we fast forward to 1908, and Cornell is around, and they cross Winchell with a grape called Moore's Diamond, and that created a grape that they named Ontario. So here we are in 1908, and we have Ontario. Then Fast forward again to 1932, and Cornell crosses Ontario with a very famous grape, Zinfandel, and it produces a grape called Schuler, or Schuyler. I'm not exactly sure on the pronunciation on that one, but probably not that important for the story. Because then we fast forward to 1945, and we cross that grape with a grape that I just mentioned, Sauval Blanc. And the aim of that cross was to combine Sauval's quality, which it's definitely, when we work with it here, I can attest to that. It makes a really great wine on its own, and it makes a really good wine as a component, because it's got almost like a Sauvignon Blanc-like character to it, and so it just lends itself to a lot of different styles. So they were trying to get the hardiness of the Schuler grape with the Sauvignon quality, and so it was released in 1972. So it took a lot of testing and basically, you know, trying to make sure it was disease-free, that they could replicate it. And so it was the first variety released by Cornell specifically for winemaking. So there's a couple caveats in there. I think they had released other stuff too, but it sort of has that as a feature, I guess. Characteristics of, say, of Cayuga White are it's vigorous and high yielding, and we can attest to that. We just picked it this week, and we were kind of like, holy smokes, that was a lot of fruit that came in, and yet the vines looked really good. Even in a droughty year, you know, they showed no signs of drought stress. It tends to throw a really nice loose cluster, so it's very disease resistant. It's one of those grapes that, frankly, we never think about during the season, and that is a very good thing. So I'm impressed with its hardiness for sure. It also tends to be very juicy. So in other words, a typical white grape would yield anywhere between maybe 150 and 160 gallons of wine, finished wine, per ton of fruit. That's kind of a metric that we use to sort of plan out things like tank space and financial projections. And this runs 165 to 180, depending on, and even this year, again, with how droughty it is, you'd expect to be, you know, at the low end of the threshold. And we saw, at least so far, pretty good yields on that in terms of the gallons that you're going to get per ton. So that those are some really good things that make it a really great grape to work with. Also, we have found, and this isn't just us, I've definitely talked to other winemakers who agree with this, pick it a little bit on the earlier side. So we like to pick it between 17 and 19 Brix. It avoids it getting that sort of foxy character, which is coming in from the La Brusca family, no doubt. And so by picking it on the earlier side of that ripening window, it really gives it that really crisp, clean flavor that we're looking for. So if you do that, you should expect a really crisp, fruit-driven wine. The types of flavors you're going to get, apple, citrus, peach, tropical fruit. Sometimes we jokingly call it Riesling Light. So you get that sort of stone fruit character, but not quite as rich and developed as Riesling. So when we mix it with Riesling, as we do in one of those blends, you can obviously see where those wines would work well together. So that's the Cayuga White grape. You know, you'll see it on its own for sure. I think it is a pretty nice standalone wine, but it definitely is one that plays well with others too. So making it into a blend is a great way to use it if you're considering growing it. If you are considering growing it, I would do the research first, make sure your site makes sense for it. And if you have any questions about kind of our experience and how we have it trellised and set up, just reach out to us. Again, you can find me at craftpourdecisions.com, and there's a contact us area that's really great for throwing in your questions. That's where I get a lot of my ideas, as folks kind of reach out to me either through that official channel or through some other channel to sort of ask a question. Then it kind of gets me going down the rabbit hole, and then next thing you know, I try to share what we've learned with listeners. So with all, however many of you are, we're still young and getting started on this thing. So please share with this with your friends if you find it to be at all interesting, entertaining, or whatever, even if it just puts you to sleep at night, just, you know, share it. We're trying to get more people involved. It's been a lot of fun for me. It's more of a passion project for me. So I don't really look at the stats, frankly, but it's always nice to hear from people that are paying attention. Okay, so the This Won't Pour segment, which I forgot to name in the last episode, so I apologize to our friends over at Carrier Signal. I put the plug into the podcast, but it was after the fact. So the the This Won't Pour segment during harvest updates is going to be when we dive deep into a harvest facet, which generally doesn't involve a lot of pouring. So it sort of fits, but we're going to make it fit either way. This is one of the most common questions I get when I do tours at Penn Valley or wherever I am in out talking to people about wine making, especially during harvest. And their question is some flavor of how do you pick the grapes? You know, I think they have this vision of something. I can't quite figure out what maybe their preconception is of how it works, but it definitely doesn't seem to line up with what I tell them we do because they seem to be sort of flabbergasted by the whole process. And so, and I'll be the first to admit, I think that this is going to change a lot in the next 10 or 15 years. I've seen some really interesting stuff being done on table grapes with different types of machines to pick that really take what we do and move it into a whole different ball game. Because I'll talk about this in a second, but there's definitely some real constraints to what we currently do in terms of getting that fruit off of the vines. The This Won't Pour segment is sponsored by Carrier Signal. Carrier Signal is an IT services provider specializing in small and medium businesses with unique needs. They handle everything from technology and security assessments, cloud migration, point-of-sale integration, and cloud-based phone systems. Learn more at www.carriersignal.com. So here we are. You know, it's the end of the growing season. We've been at it now for, you know, months and months and months. It really, you know, almost a year if you go back to the initial kind of pruning from the prior year. And the grapes are ripe, as we already talked about how we determine ripeness. We talked about that in episode one. If you want to learn more about that, reverse back to us in your favorite podcast player and check that one out. So they're ready to go, and now it's time to pick. And so we have a machine harvester, and a lot of wineries do. So the question is, are you going to use that? Or are you going to go pick by hand? And why would you do one or the other? And some of it is going to depend on what type of harvester you have. So I'm most familiar with a very kind of old style of harvester, which is essentially a modified blueberry shaker that was modified to work better with the type of trellising systems that we use for grapes as opposed to blueberries, but they have a lot in common. And essentially, the machine will ride over the top of the row and shake the trellis and plant such that the berries release from the rachis, they fall down, and they're caught in either these like cups or a belt that essentially is underneath the vine, and it can move so that if it hits posts and plants, it can sort of open a little bit, but you're trying to catch as much of that fruit as possible, and inevitably some juice because some of the berries will break as they fall and whatnot. So it's very efficient because basically you've got a driver, and then you've got a driver of the harvester, and then depending on the harvester configuration, some harvesters will actually pick directly into a box on board, kind of like a combine can do, and then can offload that into an adjacent vehicle when they're full. Some will offload in real time to the adjacent row. So there's like an elevator conveyor that will then convey the fruit to an adjacent row where there's another trailer, typically with your bin boxes in it, or totes, or gondolas, depending on the configuration at the receiving winery. And the fruit just kind of falls into there. And then again, depending on the machine, in that conveyance system, there might be some onboard sorting to get rid of what we call MOG, or material other than grape. There might be some optical sorting technology. There's a lot of stuff that's happening more in the vineyard that used to happen at the crush pad. But it can happen anywhere. It doesn't really matter where it happens, although the faster it happens, typically the better. The sooner, rather, the better. And so you have, you know, now we're only up to a couple people. You know, each of the tractors has an operator, and then you're probably going to have two tractors catching fruit because they do fill up pretty quick. And so you're going to have to go back to your wherever you're loading, if it's a remote vineyard onto a, you know, truck, or if it's your home vineyard back to your crush pad. And so you got these two, you know, tractors kind of doing a rotation so that you're not slowing down the harvest process. And then you might have somebody kind of managing, you know, on the ground to make sure, like, for example, there might be some grapes missed at the beginning or end of rows. You might have obstructions in certain rows. We've got a, I've seen rows with some power poles in them, so now you can't drive over them, so you got to hand harvest a row. So there's often another person that's just kind of a floater, but that's compared to hand harvesting, which basically what you do there is you take a special cutting device and a person, and they'll cut each cluster off of the vine and usually drop it into a small box and then can transfer that to a larger box, and that gets transferred to the winery. A typical person can pick about a ton of fruit per day, and so you're really limited on the quantity of fruit that you can harvest when you're going by hand. But there's a couple of important considerations. So let's take it in two buckets here, and we'll try to make this as high level as possible. But the first bucket of what you might choose to pick is going to be, let's just say, more based on the mechanics. So certain vineyards, especially if you're using a VSP system, the problem is your fruit's pretty low, and since you're driving over the row, you have to have a lot of travel in that machine in order to shake as close to the fruit as possible, while still, you know, being on top of the row. So that can be kind of a challenge, because you're basically have to shake sometimes harder, in order to get that fruit to fall off, and that hard shaking can damage canes that we may want for next year. It can, of course, damage trellis that we definitely want for next year. Also, sometimes the grapes just don't want to release as easily, you know, especially if it's droughty. Sometimes they're just hanging on, and so that can be a challenge. Sometimes you go out with a plan for the time it's going to take, and it just takes longer because you got to go slower, because you've got to shake a little bit harder or longer to get the fruit off. And of course, the longer you're shaking, the more damage you're doing. So that's part of it, is the mechanics. You know, can we physically safely harvest that block with a machine? And so, and other times it could also be that the slope is too dangerous, because again, you're way up high riding over those rows, and so you definitely can't harvest if there's a certain slope angle that would exceed that. Now, there are certain harvesters that do the same thing, but they're pulled behind a tractor. That makes them more efficient, because the engine you can use for other stuff as opposed to only for harvesting. But they do tend to be a little trickier, because you're not riding right on top of the row, so you've got to definitely, you know, learn how to run those. They'll often have cameras and sensors that make that easier nowadays. Okay, so that's like the one thing. So if you physically can't harvest it by machine, then it's obvious that you're going to hand harvest. The other is more nuanced, and that really relates to the wine that you're trying to make, and that will also have a big impact on the type of machine harvester that you have. So I'm going to have to speak in sort of broad terms, so this isn't a three-hour podcast, but just as a general rule, even your most, you know, gentle modern harvesters are going to be harder on the fruit than hand harvesting. And also with a machine, you're taking only the berry. You're not taking the rachis. And that can be good or bad depending on what you're trying to do. But in general, because even if you've gently shaked that fruit off, you've now at least broken that connection between the rachis and the fruit, such that you're going to start having some skin contact with the juice. Again, a tiny amount on a really modern harvester, quite a bit on some of these older harvesters that are shaking a little bit harder and less close to the fruit zone. And so if you're trying to make a wine that's really delicate and the skins would potentially be problematic, I'll give you a couple of examples. Sparkling wine is a great one, because those skin phenolics are going to be accentuated by the carbon dioxide in the champagne or sparkling wine, and can be really off-putting. So it's pretty uncommon to machine a sparkling base. The second would be something like Pinot Grigio. And when we make a Pinot Grigio, we only hand harvest. In fact, we also do what's called whole cluster pressing, which is something we'll probably get to in the next episode, how the presses work. But you know, we're really trying to reduce that skin contact on that wine, because we want that really light, really delicate flavor and aromatic profile. And we know that those skins are going to add this other aspect that we don't find to be what we're looking for. So that's a big part of it. On the flip side, something like a red that's going to spend, you know, a week to 2 weeks on its skins, well, obviously it doesn't matter if you pick it with a machine, because you're just starting that process a bit on the earlier side. So that can make a difference too. The other thing I'll mention, although it's less of a constraint in terms of technology and more of just sort of your workforce and what kind of a team you have at your disposal, is two things. One is speed. You know, obviously, when I say a person can do a ton, you know, the machine can do 20, 30 tons in a day, easy. So it's a very different situation. But if you have a massive picking team, that could be irrelevant. You know, there's certainly these picking machines are very expensive. So, you know, depending on the size of your farm and how much of it you can machine harvest, it may make absolutely no sense for you to have a machine that can pick. We're seeing a lot in places where there's a lot of vineyards is, of course, somebody will buy the machine and then they'll sort of sublease their services out to the adjacent farms in order to help return on that investment. Because you're talking anywhere, you know, maybe a good used one you might be able to pick up for $250,000 all the way up to $500,000+ for these things. I mean, there's sort of the sky's the limit. You can add a whole bunch of fancy stuff onto them and make them a pretty expensive investment. So the other thing is, again, not so much an issue of technology, but one of the nice things about machine harvesting is it's pretty efficient to do at night. The machines have a lot of lights typically on them, and because you have less people out there and they don't have to actually see the fruit, you can run these at night, and that helps because it's cooler at night, and so the fruit comes in colder than if you had waited until, you know, the daytime to pick. Again, this can be overcome. I see a lot of harvesting. We do it too, where you bring in light kits, kind of like the ones they use for construction projects on the highway, and you can light the vineyards and start picking in the middle of the night, and it works great. But of course, now you've got this sort of human capital challenge, which is, you know, you've got to bring people in the middle of the night. So then that messes up the shifts later on as far as, you know, when you might want to do it in a daytime operation. So it's not, you know, just so simple as saying, hey, everybody, let's show up at 11 p.m. and get to work. You know, it takes some careful planning to do that. So those are some of the considerations between hand harvesting and machine harvesting. And I think, you know, a lot of wineries, you know, have very specific pieces of equipment or very specific processing goals that may drive them into one of those or the other of those. Also, it's worth mentioning, if you're going to do any stem inclusion in your winemaking, which is a fairly common practice, particularly in red wine production, then of course you're not going to be able to machine harvest because the stems are being left behind. So that's another area where you'd automatically be hand picking if you want to do stem inclusion. So hopefully that demystifies that the little bit of the process and kind of gives everybody an update on what's going on around the Fenville AVA. Again, talking to other winemakers, I'd say they're sort of similar to what we're experiencing right now, sort of the very beginning of what's going to be a pretty chaotic probably next 2 or 3 weeks. We'll have a lot of grapes to name at this time next week, and we'll do our best to bring you some more commentary from the front lines here as we go through Harvest 2025. So that wraps another episode of Poor Decisions. We are presented by Fen Valley and brought with IT and creative design by Carrier Signal. Please follow our show on your favorite podcast platform. You can also find us on social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram. See all the places you can interact with us and submit your questions or comments. Head to www.craftpoordecisions.com. Thanks for listening. Cheers.